Okay, ladies and gentlemen, no. It's a great pleasure. We succeeded to get Don Eigler here from IBM Armadel. And we are already used to the fact that these experimentalists can do things that are beyond belief. But even after all these experiences, I think we are going to see a few further examples of that. And if anybody here had any doubt at all that the electron is a wave, I think their doubts will be strongly removed after some of these demonstrations. And it's a real pleasure to have Donald give us talk about the quantum mirage and other things.
Right. Thanks, Joe. We're supposed to be able to do things that other people can't believe. Well, I can't juggle these strange things. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for... Yeah, this is fine. Actually, I started... I once gave a lecture to the Institute of Princeton, Institute for Advanced Studies at Princeton. And indeed, I had hidden under the lectern some of my juggling balls. And I started it by getting up in front of them to juggle. It was an unusual way to start a seminar. But if you do want to get adrenaline in your system at the beginning of a talk, go to the Institute for Advanced Studies and begin your talk by juggling. Right? That, guaranteed to work. As Joe mentioned, the title of my presentation today is Quantum Mirages. And can we dim the lights? Yeah, that would be fine. And I'm delighted to see a low-tech pointer. I love low-tech pointers, such as this, because you can not only point to things on the screen, but if there are recalcitrant members of the audience, you can keep them in line. Let me use this as an outline of the first part of my presentation. This work was done primarily by Harry Minoharin, who is now a professor at Stanford University. Chris Lutz is an engineer at IBM. To call him an engineer that's his technical title. Chris is the brains of the group. He really is extraordinary. And I get to work with these guys. What you're looking at is an elliptical ring of, in this case, cobalt atoms on top of the copper 111 surface. Copper 111 surface has electrons and surface states. They move as a free electron gas. And what we've done is we've introduced to one of the foci of this ellipse one additional cobalt atom. And we've asked, how does the presence of that additional cobalt atom perturb the electronic structure in the interior of that ellipse? And this is a map of how the electronic structure has changed due to the presence of that one additional cobalt atom. To see that there is a local large change due to this atom is, of course, what we expect. It's no surprise. To see that there is a large remote change came as a surprise for us. What I want to do is I want to walk you through the surface state electrons to give you an idea about that, tell you what it is that we're measuring. What we're looking at is something which is a result of classical physics as manifest in a quantum system, although we will also see that we're probing a Kondo system in this experiment. We'll learn a little bit about these kinds of Kondo systems. And we'll see why this might be interesting to a corporation like IBM. But since this is the nanoscience workshop at ITP, let me take a moment, just a very brief moment, to try to paint for you a picture why the physics of almost anything that's really small is now important to IBM and indeed to all the information technology industry. And the reason for that is, simply put, it is the future of our hardware technologies. If you think about the history of what has brought about these extraordinary machines that we use every day, these computers, what has made that possible and what is fueling the information technology revolution is the ability to shrink the size of the components that do computation and to shrink it again and again and again. This is true for what goes into making a chip. It's true for data storage. We definitely want to continue this process. It plays in very well to our business model. And we're making some very small things that go into our chips, and we're exploring the things that we might want to use in the future. When things get really small, the physics becomes perhaps more interesting, and the opportunities for doing things, for doing computation, might grow tremendously. We might not be doing computation in a chip by flowing electrons from place to place, by controlling their momentum and position degrees of freedom. We might be doing computation by just controlling the spin degree of freedom only. We might even be doing mechanical computation. Mechanics becomes very interesting again on a nanoscale structure. So one of the things that we want to do in IBM in terms, with the motivation rather, of getting ourselves ready for the future, is to make sure we have a firm foundation of knowledge of the physics of nanometer scale structures. That's very much what my job is. And to explore what are the structures which would be optimum for doing computation in the future. The tool that I use in my laboratory is a scanning tunneling microscope. And I just want to use one view graph to emphasize the various modes in which we use the tunneling microscope, and also to emphasize what an extraordinarily versatile tool this is. The three modes that we'll use it in are described here. The one in which it was invented for was to do atomic resolution imaging, also to do spectroscopy. In the atomic resolution imaging mode, you can think about what you're doing is you're asking, how are the electrons in a particular energy level or in a particular band of energies distributed in space at some density contour which is typically so low that it's far outside the surface? So you're asking, how are the electrons far outside the surface that you're studying distributed in space, and learning from that something about what's going on with the atoms underneath, perhaps their positions, perhaps how they're interacting with other atoms. In the spectroscopy mode, which is the complementary mode, instead of asking how are the electrons at a particular energy distributed in space, you ask and get the answer to the question, how are the electrons at a particular position distributed in energy? It's a completely complementary mode. That's a kind of spectroscopy which is entirely equivalent to the kind of tunneling spectroscopy that was done in the 1960s with sandwich tunnel junctions, but now you do it in a local way with the idea that you know what you're measuring. You can see what's underneath. And then importantly for the experiments I'll describe today, we use a tunneling microscope as a set of hands to put the atoms where we want them to go. In order to bring you up to speed, I have to take a moment or two and give you a mini tutorial on the surface state electrons on the copper surface and our ability to image them with the tunneling microscope and what we can learn from that. This is a scanning tunneling microscope image of the copper 111 surface at 4 degrees Kelvin. The 111 surface is one where the atoms are just close packed. They're in a simple triangular lattice, at least a 2D part. To give you an idea, in this image, as in, I believe, all of the STM images I will show you today, at least the perspective images, the vertical scale has been greatly exaggerated in order to convey the content of the information content of the data. And in particular, in this image, the vertical scale has been blown up by a factor of around 47 compared to the in-plane scale of the image. This is about 400 angstroms across from left to right. You don't see the individual copper atoms. If you could, there would be nominally 180 or so copper atoms from left to right. This is where the crystal of copper goes up, one layer of atoms. This is roughly two-thirds of an atomic diameter. That's how blown up it is. What we see on this surface is the appearance of ripples decorating the step edges and some, but notice not all, of the point defects on the surface. We know from photoemission experiments that the copper 111 surface supports a two-dimensional electron gas. This is because the Fermi surface intersects the first Brillouin zone in the 111 direction, creating a gap in the bulk band structure. And that allows there to be these kind of Shockley surface states. It's been known that these electrons act like free electron gas from their dispersion relation anyway. It's just E goes as K squared. And that's known from photoemission. So what happens is when the electrons come along, they find potentials which is surface state electrons. They're moving around the surface of two-dimensional gas. They see scattering potentials such as one created here at the step edge or some of these defects, and that gives you a reflected wave. So what you see here is the density distribution, which can most simply and properly be thought of as just the standing wave. This is just the result of an incoming electron wave, a reflected wave, you add the two together and that gives you the density distribution that you see here. This is the density distribution at a particular energy. This just happens to be at the Fermi energy. I could have done the same experiment at a different energy. If you add up over all energies, then you have the classic Fidel oscillation only at KF, or KF, 2KF rather. To give you an idea, the surface state electron effective mass is 0.38, and that gives it a rather long Fermi wavelength. In particular, the Fermi wavelength for these surface state electrons is about 30 angstroms. That's wonderful for us because that allows us to have lateral resolution on which with a tele microscope is of the order of 2 or 3 angstroms, so that we have lateral resolution on a scale short compared to the Fermi wavelength of the Fermi wavelength over 2. So the distance from crest to crest here is just lambda Fermi over 2, that's 15 angstroms. And to give you an idea about the kind of sensitivity of the tunneling microscope, where these ripples are largest, right next to the step edge, the peak to valley corrugation is just about 4/100 of an angstrom. To make these measurements, you need a tunneling microscope which has quite a lot of stability, but there are many that have that stability around the world right now. It is delightful for us. Our microscope continues to improve. It now can see down to about 2/10,000 of an angstrom, and you might ask yourself, why do you need that? Oh, many people ask that question. You're concerned about this. Atomic scale gophers. Perhaps you've seen what gophers can do to a lawn. It is not important to what I told you, but not too far away from the area in which we took this picture, I can't remember whether we did this on purpose or mistakenly. We rammed the tip into the surface in a something resembling 100 mile an hour car slamming into a brick wall. And we call it jackhammering the surface. That created glide plane dislocations. That gave us these very defect-free perfect steps, Ed. And we think that this is a dislocation, a special kind of surface dislocation, akin to the reconstruction that happens on the gold 111 surface. But it's rank speculation on our part. So we like to call it atomic scale gophers. We found we wanted to do experiments where we could further confine these surface state electrons in the plane of the surface. And what we needed to do is we wanted to find an atom which would be a sufficiently strong scatterer of the surface state electrons and an atom which we could manipulate on the surface. Our first try was iron. This is an STM image of a single iron atom on top of the copper 111 surface. This peak in the center is just a density distribution due to the electronic structure of the iron atom itself. It has an apparent height of about 0.9 angstroms. Now you can begin to appreciate why you want a microscope with very high resolution. You need that to be able to resolve these Fidel oscillations around the atom. And this just shows that the iron atom does have a scattering cross-section which is large enough to result in a scattered wave which gives us a density distribution which we can measure with a tunneling microscope. Then using many of these iron atoms and our atom manipulation abilities, which I'm not going to describe today, let me just take a moment to say that even after more than 10 years of moving atoms, I was moving a carbon monoxide molecule just yesterday for some visitors, and I had some visitors moving the molecules around. And to this day, I still really get excited about it. It's really a lot of fun. We took the iron atoms and we arranged them in a circular structure. The mean radius here is 73 angstroms, and the purpose was to try to confine the electrons into what you could call a quantum dot. We called it a quantum corral because this was reminiscent of a fence that you'd have on a corral. The colors here are false. If you ever see color in my images, it's just an effort to convey in an aesthetic way the density distribution, or if you like, the trajectory of the tip of the microscope to be more precise. What you see here in the interior is the density distribution of the states which have a significant amount of state density right at the Fermi level where we were making this measurement. And we wanted to see if we could understand this density distribution. In fact, it can be modeled quite well by solving the classic problem of a particle in a hard wall box. You can do a better job of understanding that density distribution, and that was done by Rick Heller at Harvard University, who cooked up a nice little scattering theory for calculating this density distribution. In that scattering theory, you model the injected electron as an outgoing circular wave from the position of the tip. You follow that wave out to each iron atom, which you take to be as a single particle scatterer. You don't worry about multiple scattering effects. You parameterize the scattering at the iron atom with a complex scattering phase shift, and then you follow the scattered wave not only back to the tip, but out to all other atoms, and the second, you can do the calculation to all orders of scattering that way. Using that theory, the only free parameters that you really have, or that you really need to fit in order to compare with the data, is the complex scattering phase shift, a two-parameter fit. And with that two-parameter fit, the spectrum at the center of the corral could be calculated quite well. This is the first spectrum I'm showing you, and I'm going to show you many more, so let me just spend a moment to describe it to you. This is the conductance of the tunnel junction, which is proportional to the first approximation, is proportional to the local density of states at the position of the tip. In this case, the tip was located at the center, right at the center of a circular corral. It was a larger corral than this, but that doesn't really matter. And the result of making that measurement was a solid line that you see here, where V is the voltage applied, and 0 volts, which is somewhere in over here somewhere, corresponds to the Fermi energy. This is the bottom of the surface, say, band down here at I think it's minus 0.44 volts. What you see in the solid line is the experimental result, is we find that the density is peaked at characteristic energies. Equivalently, there are gaps between those peaks. And this shows us that the electrons are going into discrete energy levels. They are quantized in this structure. And with that two parameters to fit, this is the calculated spectrum that you see here with the dashed line. Okay, so with essentially only two free parameters, you can get a good match onto the data. Notice that you get not only the energies right, but you get the widths correct. To put things in perspective, it's a low-Q resonator. It has a Q of somewhere between 1.5 and 2. So if it was a bell, it would sound more like a thud than a good ringing bell. There are many experiments where we would appreciate having a higher Q resonator, but we haven't learned to build them yet. I want to emphasize how effective this theory is, the scattering theory of Rick Heller's, is at predicting everything that goes on inside of these structures once you have those two parameters fit. We use the spectrum that you see here to get a complex scattering phase shift. Once you've got that, you've got everything. So you should be able to calculate a density distribution. And that's what's shown here. The bottom is a stadium-shaped corral. Each one of these white blobs is the iron atom that's sort of washed out because we wanted to distribute our contrast in this image in the middle part of the stadium. This is the experimental result. This is the calculated density distribution for the same conditions where now there were no free parameters. So what you should... Let me just review where we are right now. We have two-dimensional free electron gas that we have a pretty good understanding of on top of the copper surface. We know how to confine the gas into lower dimensional structures, indeed into quantum dots, these so-called quantum corrals that we can build. And once we parameterize the scattering of the surface state electrons at an isolated ad atom, such as the iron atoms that we use to make the corral walls, we can then calculate the spectra and the density distribution of these structures with quite a degree of accuracy.
Can I just check, when you say that you have a complex scattering phase, is that to represent electrons being scattered from the surface states into the bottom?
There are four scattering channels. When a surface state electron scatters off of an impurity or some potential on the surface, it could scatter elastically into a surface state, inelastically into a surface state, elastically into a bulk state, or inelastically into a bulk state. The imaginary term, the term which accounts for the loss that we see, the width in the spectrum, actually has contributions from three of those channels. Anything which is a loss of the state density is going, of the integrated state density, is going to end up being part of that term. So both elastic and inelastic scattering into the bulk plus inelastic scattering into the surface state all end up being lumped together. We cannot differentiate between those three channels based on our experimental result or on the theory. Our best guess is that that channel is dominated by elastic scattering into the bulk. Yeah?
Since you have this gas of many, many surface electrons, is what you're measuring on the basically the mean field value of the electron field?
It is. Yeah, it mean field I think would end up giving you exactly the same thing, but what we measure in the laboratory, if there was something that went beyond mean field that you could not properly describe with a mean field theory, we would measure it and we would see in the laboratory, and we would be able to see the distinction between what we measure and a mean field calculation. So if there was some kind of special many-body effect going on there or something, it would show up in what we end up measuring. What we end up measuring is actually, properly, it's not even the local density of states. If we really want to be proper about it, what we end up measuring is the local density of quasi-particle excitations in the system, single-particle excitations in the system. For normal metals, where we're not kicking up a lot of phonons, that looks primarily like the local density states. But when we start doing inelastic tunneling spectroscopy, which we do in the laboratory, then you have to go beyond a simple local density states kind of approximation. Or, for instance, when we do experiments on superconductors, which we have done, most interestingly and relevant to what I'll talk about later on, some work with magnetic impurities on a superconductor. And there, I think a mean field approach would certainly not be appropriate. By the way, let me just point out that what I've told you about so far really can be fit very well with the most elementary model of how you could treat electrons. It's just like a free electron gas, completely non-interacting, independent particles. That approximation is a very good approximation in this case. We have looked for departures from that and we haven't found them. I need to take a moment or two to talk about the Kondo effect, because we'll be looking at a Kondo system and it will become important later on in the talk. I don't want to go into it in depth. I just want to give you just a quick idea of how to think about it. It's been known since certainly the 1960s that if you have certain magnetic impurities which are immersed in non-magnetic metallic hosts, you can have the so-called Kondo systems, in which when you drop below a characteristic temperature called the Kondo temperature, there's a magnetic screening cloud which the conduction electrons form around the magnetic impurity to end up giving you a system with no net magnetic moment. The susceptibility goes away. This also leads to a rise in the resistance at low temperature, but I won't go into that in any depth. It is widely suspected or believed that the screening cloud would look like it does in this cartoon here, where the magnetization oscillates and decays, and it oscillates on the Fermi wavelength scale. But it's not... it's lambda Fermi over 2 to go from here to here, lambda Fermi over 4 to go from here to here. And the whole combination of conduction electron screening cloud, the Kondo cloud, plus magnetic impurity gives you no net moment. In the late 1990s, two groups in the world simultaneously found that they could observe the Kondo resonance at the Fermi energy, which is brought about by this interaction, the scattering interaction, this many-body interaction between the conduction electrons and the magnetic impurity. That was work done in Mike Cromie's group and at Boston University, where they saw the Kondo resonance for cobalt adsorbed on the gold surface, and work done in Wolf-Dieter Schneider's group at the University of Lausanne, where they saw the same effect and they had the same interpretation for the system of cerium on silver 111. Let me take a moment to describe to you what the Kondo resonance looks like experimentally. It is always at the Fermi energy. We know that from theory. And what's going to be important for the first part of my talk is that it is a unique signature which we can identify from the other spectroscopic signatures that we will see on the surface. Those other spectroscopic signatures include bulk band structure, the band structure of the tip, the electronic structure of the tip, the wiggles in the local density states due to the standing waves on the surface. But we can very clearly identify the Kondo resonance from these other structures for two reasons. One, we know it's always at the Fermi energy. And two, it just happens to be much narrower in energy than any of the other spectroscopic features that I just described. So here's some spectra taken with the tunneling microscope in our laboratory for the system of cobalt on copper. And cobalt is going to be the magnetic impurity atom that I'm going to describe extensively coming up. This is a range from minus 500 to plus 500 millivolts, and here we go to a narrower energy range. That's what too much coffee will do for you. All I want you to appreciate about this is that the Kondo resonance signature is local in energy, is always right at the Fermi energy, and it's very easy to distinguish from everything else that's going on. This happens to be a Fano resonance as we measure it. That's because the tunneling electrons can tunnel directly into the bulk states of the copper or into the surface state band also. That provides a continuum of states, or they can tunnel into the resonance state, the Kondo resonance, and then off into the bulk states from there. Yeah. No, it can be a dip, a bump, a step up, or a step down, and hopefully we'll get to that. We understand that. When you have the tip directly above the cobalt atom, it happens to be a dip. And if you ever put the tip directly above, it will always look like a dip. But I'll show you another way to measure it later on. Not only is this resonance local in energy, it is also local in space, and that's emphasized in this view graph. This is, again, spectra taken right at the Fermi energy, which is here. The black curve here is a spectra taken where the tip of the microscope is directly over the cobalt atom. We then take the tip and move it, in this case, one angstrom away. That's the red curve, one angstrom to the side. And we repeat the same measurement, and we see that the magnitude is slightly decreased. But notice by the time we get to five or even seven angstroms away from the cobalt atom, the Kondo resonance signature is almost completely gone from our spectra. So this signature, which is going to be important for the first part of the talk, is local, both in energy and in space. There's a way to use the tunneling microscope in which you not only measure the conventional topographic data, but you can also be sensitive to changes in the electronic structure at the position of the tip. And the way we do that is to apply a small modulation voltage, which allows us to measure the differential conductance at the bias voltage while we're scanning the tip across the surface. And I like to tell everybody in the audience, if you've been sleeping up to this point, which is perfectly fine, and if you want to sleep after this view graph, that's perfectly fine, but you need to wake up for this view graph, because if you don't understand this view graph, the rest of the talk is going to be impenetrable. It's not that tough. Here's an isolated cobalt atom on the copper surface. Well, it's almost isolated. There are some other atoms not too far away. It's about 35 angstroms, 35 angstroms across. The colors are false. This is where the cobalt atom, cobalt, is used to make the color blue, cobalt oxides. Copper is copper colored. These are the standing waves around the cobalt atom. It's not ideally circular because there are other atoms nearby and it's a complex standing wave field. Don't worry about that. At the same time that we collected this data that you see here, we were applying a small modulation voltage and measuring the differential conductance. And this is a map of that differential conductance as a function of where the tip was at the same time that we measured this data here. We tuned our DC bias voltage to be right on the edge of the Kondo resonance. And what that does is it makes the height of the tip extremely sensitive to the presence or absence of the Kondo resonance. If the Kondo resonance is not there, the tip has to pull out a little bit farther away from the surface, making the conductance low, and that's what you see here is the dark part. And as you come over the Kondo resonance, the tip has to come in higher, making the conductance higher, and it makes this large. Without going into any great detail, and it's not worth it, just as a matter of faith, take it that this is a map telling you where the Kondo resonance signature is large. It's not only sensitive to the Kondo resonance. If there was some other electronic structure feature at the energy range between the bias voltage and the Fermi energy, it would also contribute to this map. But as you'll see, we'll be able to easily distinguish those kinds of things from the Kondo resonance.
So we should come out from this seeing that the scale, the spatial scale, over which the Kondo resonance exists.
Right, and it will tell us where there's something that looks like it's a Kondo resonance happening on the surface.
That's a very small scale. It's really a lambda F scale.
This is substantially less than lambda F. Let me point that out. And it's much smaller than what we think would be some kind of correlation length based on the correlation length calculated by using V Fermi and the Kondo temperature giving you the energy.
Orders
of magnitude smaller than that,
that
correct.
That length doesn't come in. It's very interesting.
That's correct, and we don't think we're... Well, no, I'm not going to say anything about that. It's not fully... Oh, I will say something about that. It is not understood by me.
You know, it's in the same direction as experiments showing that limiting the size of the system below that length doesn't really influence very much the Kondo temperature. So that length somehow does not play a role for reasons that have to be understood.
Correct. I would say correct. Yes. And I was just going to point that out. If we look this. The signature is very small by the time we get out to 7 angstroms. For the surface state electrons, 7 angstroms is about 1/4 the Fermi wavelength. So it decays rapidly.
Back to the...
To this one.
Why is it a large difference in the apparent spatial precision that you found between those two? What limits your spatial precision?
You mean the lateral resolution of the microscope? It's really about the same here. This probably has to do with the fact that this ramps up very large, very, very rapidly there. The current that flows out of the tip has been calculated to be distributed over, imagine it flows in a cylindrical column between the outermost atom of the tip and the surface. And if that column had a diameter of about 2.5 or 3 angstroms, that would contain about 90-95% of the current. So the tunneling microscope is certainly doing an average over the electronic structure over lateral dimensions comparable to an atomic size. But if you have a very rapid change in electronic structure on the surface, you'd still see that as a very rapid change, but probably limited to about a 2 angstrom full width. If you had, for instance, a step function in the electronic structure, a lateral step function in the electronic structure, and you measured it with the tunneling microscope, it would probably be spread out over at least two or so angstroms. I have no reason to. Yeah, I think if we did a careful analysis rather than looking at the data this way, we would see it was comparable. Now, a little bit of history. Harry and I were very interested, and indeed I am still very much interested, and it is the theme of the research in my laboratory, to study the physics of very small magnetic systems. What happens when you stick 2, 3, 5 magnetic atoms together on a surface? I want to understand that physics. I want to learn how to possibly use that physics for things computational. And we were trying to come up with a system where we had 2 magnetic atoms that were strongly coupled to one another on the surface, but that we could work with so that they weren't stuck together just as dimers. And our scheme for doing that, or at least what we were thinking about doing, was to locate the 2 magnetic atoms that we wanted to couple at the foci of an elliptical quantum corral and try to use elliptical quantum corral and its state density to get an enhanced RKKY coupling between these 2 magnetic atoms. We have not succeeded at a conclusive demonstration that that is doable. That's still an experiment which is on the list of things to do. But let me describe to you how we got there. The motivation was for using an ellipse was to exploit the geometrical property of an ellipse, that the path length from one focus to any place on what I'll call the wall, because it's the wall of the corral, to the other focus is independent of where on the wall you go, so that if you have an outgoing circular wave which starts at one focus, it will always coalesce in phase over at the other focus. That was our motivation. And we start off with an empty ellipse that you see here. It has an eccentricity of 1/2, a semi-major axis of 71 angstroms or so. That's the distance from here to here. Each one of the wall atoms is a cobalt atom in this case. And so if we make this simultaneous measure of where we have a Kondo resonance signature, you see each one of these cobalt atoms lights up very strongly. It has a Kondo resonance right at that atom. You'll notice that there's also some structure here in the interior of the corral. That is due to the electronic structure of the quantum states in the interior. They give you an oscillating electronic background, which I showed to you before, but I did not emphasize. Let me just emphasize it. They are responsible for creating these wiggles that you see out here. These wiggles are not nearly as sharp in energy, and they're not necessarily right at the Fermi energy as the Kondo resonance. So when they contribute to these images, they don't contribute nearly as strong a signal. And that's why you see something here due to the quantum states, which is relatively weak compared to the Kondo resonance. But remember, we've chosen our experimental conditions to emphasize where there is a Kondo resonance. The next part of the experiment was to place a single magnetic atom at one of the foci of that ellipse that's shown here. Here's the Kondo resonance signatures. We see the additional Kondo resonance at the presence of this atom. And then almost any other postdoc would say, okay, now let's stick 2 magnetic atoms in. But Harry, being a very good postdoc, now professor, if I start boasting about my postdocs too much, just tell me to shut up. It's one of the great joys of my life to work with these people, and I just love it. Harry says, what is the consequence, or asked, what is the consequence of adding this single atom over here? How does it change the electronic structure in the interior? And one of the ways to analyze that is to just take this data and subtract it from this data that you see over here to ask how the electronic structure has changed in the interior. And this is the result. And it was not what we were expecting. The surprise was to find a large effect over at the other focus where there is no atom. We started calling this thing a mirage, and our motivation for calling it a mirage was just that a mirage, which is not a hallucination, is due to the bending of light waves in their path from getting from the source into your eyes. And here we were thinking it was the electrons which had scattered off of this atom, being reflected coherently by the elliptical ring of cobalt atoms, creating an effect over here, and we just chose the word mirage. You know, I'm not going to argue with that point. We just needed a shorthand instead of calling it that silly bump in the DIDV spectrum, which is too many syllables for us to have. And we like the sound of the word mirage. If you want to criticize me on that point, go ahead. Guilty. Right? I'm not going to argue it. Let me describe some of the control experiments that we did. What you see on the left side here is just what I showed you before, the single cobalt atom at the focus. This is the IDV difference map showing the mirage over here. We took the atom and we put it over another high symmetry position but along the minor axis. And what we see is, yes, there's a large change in electronic structure at the atom, but there's no mirage over here. And that's consistent with the idea that the physics that you're seeing has to do with the path length being the same going from one focus out to the walls and coalescing over the other focus. So you might say, okay, this idea of the path length being the same is what's important. But then we did the following experiment. I'm sorry I don't have a view graph to show it to you, but I can describe it to you. What we did was to just change the size of the elliptical corral. We kept the eccentricity fixed. We just expanded or contracted the corral. And what we found was that this mirage turned on and off quite rapidly according to the size, the overall size of the ellipse. And that's not consistent with the idea that the only thing that is important is that you have this elliptical geometry. So we knew that that was not a proper explanation for what was going on. The way we understood the system was to ask, what are the quantum states of an elliptical corral like this? So Harry did the calculation. This is a map of the density distribution of psi star psi for the same elliptical corral, same eccentricity and size. This is the lowest energy state, and then we go up in energy as we go along each row. Now, we know exactly what the size of the corral is. We know everything about the what the Fermi energy is and all the rest. And we know the Kondo resonance is right at the Fermi energy, and we're making a measurement about what happens at the Fermi energy. So you can ask which one of these states is at the Fermi energy, and this is the one shown here in the box. That's quantum state, just happens to be number 42, which usually gets a chuckle or two from the audience, which is, in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, the answer to life, the universe, and everything. We'll also point out very shortly just how extraordinarily lucky we were in finding this. Let me show you a comparison of the data that I showed you before. This is the third time you're seeing this. Again, here's the cobalt atom. The cobalt atom is at this focus, and this is the empty focus, and here's the mirage. Here's quantum state number 42, the density distribution. I want you to appreciate the similarity between the two plots. Not only is it highly peaked at these two positions, if you look here, you'll see 1, 2, 3 bands there, 3 bands here, 2, 3 dots, 3 dots, arcs out here on both sides. In fact, this is a map of quantum state number 42. All right, so what's the physics? The physics is just the physics of wave resonance structures. Let me walk you through it. It's actually classical physics manifest in a very small system. The analogy that I like to use is a guitar string. Imagine we have a guitar string and we pluck it. We generally excite many modes of oscillation, the fundamental and many harmonics. If I want to, I can take my finger, which I'm now going to relabel as a local modulator. It's local because it's not extended over the full length of the string. My finger is small compared to the string. And I can modulate the string by touching the string with my finger. Okay. I can take my finger and I can choose where along the string to put my finger, and I can gently touch the string once the string is put into oscillation. What's the consequence of that? The consequence is that I will selectively modulate the different modes of oscillation of the string. The modes which are vibrating a lot there will be very rapidly damped due to the presence of my finger, or if you like, due to the scattering of those waves off my finger and the interaction with my very lossy finger. If there's a mode that just happens to have a node in its mode at the point where I put my finger, almost nothing happens to that. So what I can do is I can go and I can selectively perturb. If I just touch the string gently, I can selectively perturb different modes. And then I can go along with my eye or with a guitar pickup or something, and I can ask at any point along the string, how has the modulation due to my finger manifest itself in the oscillation at that point? And to the extent that my finger is just a very weak perturbation, when I make that measurement, I will just map out the modal structure along the string. And that's what we see here. The cobalt atom is just a local modulator. It has a scattering potential. In this case, it includes the condo resonance, which makes it more interesting. But we've also done this with non-condo systems. You can make the walls out of non-condo atoms, and you can make the scatter out of non-condo atoms. You can just use just a pure Coulomb scattering term. And you can see the same kind of physics, but not as clearly, because the condo resonance really helps us make a very clear measurement of this. The condo effect and seeing the condo resonance over here does have some interesting physics to it, and we'll get to that shortly. But I just want you to appreciate that what's creating this mirage over here is really high school physics. Yeah, it really is high school physics. Now let's get to the interesting stuff. If we take the tip of the microscope and we put it over that cobalt atom that's at the focus of that ellipse, and we ask, what do we measure for the condo, what do we measure spectroscopically around zero bias, the Fermi energy at that position? We get this spectrum shown here with the tip over the cobalt atom. If we happen to move the tip towards the center, it diminishes, and we know that the condo resonance signature generally gets quite small when you go away from one of these atoms. But if you take the tip of the microscope and you put it over at the empty focus and you repeat that measurement, you once again get back a condo resonance signature, demonstrating that that electronic structure, the condo resonance, is indeed manifest and measurable at this distance far away from the atom. It's made large again, far away from the atom. If you like, you might want to say, yes, but for us, anything that we can measure is large. It's certainly small, and that it's good for you to point that out. It's not readily apparent that this is that small in this image. How large it is depends crucially on which quantum state you have. Okay, now we understand, we think, why it gets large there, and that's because we're perturbing this mode, and this particular mode that we were very fortunate to find is a very special mode. If you want to create a mirage-like structure and create a large effect at some distance away from the local modulator, what wave function would you choose? The wave function that you would choose, the optimum wave function that you could possibly choose, is a wave function which is highly peaked at just two locations and nowhere else. You want it highly peaked where you put the modulator, because if you put the modulator at, for instance, a nodal point or a point where the density is very low, you're not going to have much effect. So you need wave amplitude to scatter. Even if you have a large scatterer, if there's no wave amplitude there, it doesn't do any scattering. Okay. And then what you want is that to all be peaked up at one other point so that the local change at some other point is somewhere made large. Right. So it turns out that, we'll go back to this view graph here, it turns out that of all the possible structures in which we could have seen this mirage effect, the ellipse happens to be one of the very best. It also turns out that had we made the ellipse just a tad larger so that this state was at the Fermi energy instead of that state at the Fermi energy, we would have seen nothing and we would have been doing other experiments. I want to just point out what a great good fortune we had that just by accident, the first ellipse that we made and we did these experiments in just happened to put a very nice quantum state right at the Fermi level for us, and that was not by design. It was just by good luck.
In case if you had to put the atom in one of the peaks, you would get farther than you like to
say. You mean if we put it at one of these peaks? Right. Then we would have seen this effect here, but this is all. These are all scaled. It doesn't represent the fact that this density here is actually much higher than any one of these densities over here, because it's highly peaked at just two positions. That our distribution of colors in this plot doesn't show that effect. Yeah.
You mentioned that as you scan the size of the ellipse, which effectively scans the relative energies, you see recurrences. And presumably that's due to the fact that as you go up through those states, there's more that have resonance of that foci.
As you go up in size and you leave the atom at this position, just up a little bit, you see the mirage go away, and it still stays away, and still stays away. It pretty much stays away. You might get a little one there, and then suddenly it becomes large again. That's
right.
What's
now,
going on.
You plotted their size square, the density.
Right.
Some of these are symmetric.
Some are anti-symmetric.
With respect to size.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any difference in what you see based on symmetric versus anti-symmetric states at the Fermi energy?
Not to our knowledge. Okay, let's try to understand how it is that we get this contraresonance signature over at the empty focus. And one of our ways to make progress there was once again to turn to Rick Heller and to have him try to adapt his scattering theory to include a Kondo-like term in the scattering of the surface state electrons at these atoms. This is work I'm going to show you, which is really spearheaded by Greg Feet, who is one of Rick's graduate students. Greg is essentially an adaptation of Rick's original scattering theory. We take the wave function of the electrons, Greg takes the wave function of electrons to have two parts. This is the circular wave emanating from a tip, and this is a scatter term from each atom, where we have an outgoing circular wave from each one of the atoms on the surface, or the cobalt atoms in our case. And the important thing here is the Kondo physics is not thrown in any rigorous kind of way. It's thrown in after the fact. All they're doing in this scattering theory is they're putting in addition to the usual real and imaginary terms in the scattering phase shift, they're just putting in a term which has the right kind of energy dependence for resonance and putting it in right at the Fermi energy. And they adjust the width of this term to agree with the width that we measure when we do spectroscopy in the laboratory. So it's just a simple model. And by fitting to our data, they end up with these values. We already knew that the width of the resonance was about 9 millivolts. And for the cobalt atoms, we get reasonably good fits for the values shown here. I don't want to harp on that. But let me show you what that scattering theory can do when compared with our data in the laboratory. These are maps that look similar to what you've seen before, but I'm sorry I chose a too dark a background here. This is not the DIDV difference map or the conductance difference map. This is a map of the STM topograph showing the mirage effect in the topograph of both calculated and this side. I'm sorry, this is theory in this column, or scattering theory in this column, and this is data from our laboratory. The data in our laboratory is averaged around the semi-major axis. So you'll see no difference between the data above this line and below that line. That's the only thing that's been done. And this points out that we can actually see the effect, this mirage effect, directly in the topograph. It should have been there anyway. It's just smaller, and that's the great thing about the Kondo resonance signature, is it made it very easy to see in a definitive way. So the theory does a good job, as you can see here, of reproducing what we measure in the laboratory. If we look at that same theory and we ask it to produce DIDV maps, it does a good job. This is the data that I showed you before. The atom happens to be on the right side here. This is the mirage over here. This is what the theory predicts. And most importantly, when you use the theory to calculate the Kondo resonance signature at the position of the tip, when the tip is not at the atom but over at the empty focus, we see that the theory also predicts the Kondo resonance signature over at the empty focus. What do we think is going on? The way I like to think about it is when the tip is at the empty focus, you inject an electron into one of the surface states. That outgoing wave scatters off of the cobalt atom, which has the Kondo resonance, and it sees the Kondo resonance just the same way we see Kondo resonance when the tip is directly over the ad atom, in the sense that it sees that full scattering term, that full energy-dependent scattering term, and it participates in the Kondo resonance itself. That gives us a scattered wave, and that scattered wave comes back. And what we're really looking at is a superposition of the scattered wave, that is a reflected wave from the Kondo atom, and the outgoing circular wave from the tip itself. This would suggest, maybe I could use a, I don't need a lot of blackboard, but can people see if I sort of, is there enough room here to if I draw a tiny diagram? So what you can think of is, here's the Kondo atom over here. We'll put the tip of the microscope here, and there's an outgoing wave from the tip of the microscope. Oh, sorry, I'll step aside in just one second. The surface state electron participates in the Kondo resonance. That gives us a scattering at this point and a reflected wave over here, which has the full energy-dependent Kondo resonance signature. And what we see here is a superposition of this reflected wave and this wave giving us a Fano resonance, or something that spectroscopically, I should say, looks the same and mathematically would be the same as a Fano resonance, right? And the way we have verified this, and I'll get to that shortly if I have time, right, is by setting up experiments where we change just the distance between these two, keeping everything else fixed, and we see that this line shape that we see here can vary, and it varies in just the way that you would predict from just adding the two waves together. That is absolutely consistent with what we know. So at this point, if you were to ask me, what is the Kondo physics going on at this cobalt atom on the copper surface? I would say that we have some evidence now, because we can see it spectroscopically, that the surface state electrons are indeed participating in the Kondo resonance. That doesn't tell us whether the bulk electrons are or are not participating in the Kondo resonance. My suspicion is that they are. Certainly, if we put cobalt in copper as a bulk impurity, we know from the bulk experiments that it is a Kondo system, and we don't have surface state electrons to deal with. But I'm not sure that that allows me to say anything definitive about how the bulk electrons interact with an impurity that's on the surface. I suspect, however, that they should be below the Kondo temperature. It raises a question whether there could be two Kondo temperatures in the system, one for the surface state electrons and one for the bulk electrons. We have no data from my laboratory, no data that I'm aware of yet, which allows us to address that question. I'm curious about it, as I am about other temperatures, which, if I talk fast, I'll get to. It's about 11:30 now, so I blabbed for about 1 hour, and I was hoping to spend a little bit of time talking about our Kondo lattice experiments. So what I'd like to do is to first poll the audience and see, is there anybody who wants to stay in here a little bit about Kondo lattices? If not, then I'll just bring it to a halt right here, and we can all go off to living the rest of our lives. So, Joe, maybe you can give me some guidance. Anybody want to hear about Kondo lattices? Okay, that's enough. Okay, so but feel free to bail out, and of course, to ask questions. Now that you're a captive audience, I'm going to sneak in two view graphs very quickly. I do work for an information technology company. This is something that you've seen before. This is just an elliptical corral. It's empty, and this is a DIGB difference map. It's empty, so there's no mirage. Here we have an atom of the focus. Here there's a mirage over here. And I'd like to point out that what I've been talking about also constitutes a method for transporting information from place to place, because I can learn over at this position where whether or not there is something happening over here. And what's nice about this is it's very selective. I can make it large over at that position. It's a very interesting way to think about transporting information. It's very different from the way we conventionally do it in a chip, which is just to send electrons down a wire. The energy dissipation considerations are very different. And what's interesting about this is it doesn't matter how large an ellipse you make. The amount of energy that you dissipate stays the same. But because it's done with utilizing the wave-like properties of electrons instead of, if you like, the particle-like properties, you can do something that you cannot do with wires. And that is to send two channels of information through the same volume of space. And that's shown here. Here we just carefully quantum engineered. Chris did the quantum engineering on this. This is a really sneaky set of crossed ellipses. And we use it to demonstrate the ability to send two channels of information. Here we have what we call the left-right channel. Here there are no atoms, there's no mirages. There's an atom in the left-right channel, there's a mirage in the left-right channel, an atom in the up-down channel, a mirage in the up-down channel, and then two atoms and two mirages. And I like to emphasize, IBM is not about to start selling you quantum mirage computers next week, nor next year. What this view graph points to is something that I tried to mention at the beginning of my talk. Let me just take a moment to emphasize. When we start doing things on a very small length scale, there will be opportunities to do things differently. Whether that constitutes a way to do things better or not is what I call is unknown. And is what I would call job security. Okay, on to condo lattices.
Yeah. If you make the pictures of eigenstates for this check graph that you had before, do you find that there are four eigenstates that are close in energy to the...
You mean for this system here?
Yeah.
That was very carefully designed and getting these corners right to get degenerate states that were right at the Fermi energy. First, to get degenerate states. Tune them to being at the Fermi energy. You can do that by an overall scaling, right? And to pick states which were largely confined to just one arm and didn't extend out into the other arm. Chris is my quantum mechanic. And when I say quantum mechanic, he goes and he designs and builds quantum systems. He quantum engineers these things. It doesn't sound like, you know, if you really look at what did he do? Well, he sat down with some program that could calculate the scattering theory and another program that could calculate the states of a system like this, and that's doable, right? What's different to me and is as sort of psychologically important, it's not physically important, is that it represents sort of a new regime of device design where we really do begin wondering about and being concerned with what are the wave functions? What's the density distribution of this wave function? What are the optics of this system? That is a question that future designers are almost certainly to be increasingly concerned with, especially when we get to very small systems. Condo lattice. The idea of the condo lattice is that if you add additional magnetic moments besides the one that I showed you in my first cartoon, if we were to put in additional magnetic moments, you might expect that the condo screening cloud would now no longer be composed of just scattering states. Instead, if you put these magnetic impurities on some kind of lattice, that the screening cloud itself would be made out of block states, at least over the extent of the lattice. And then in a very cartoon-like way, you might imagine that if you had an anti-ferromagnetic interaction which resulted in the magnetization of the cloud being locally antipolar in the opposite direction from the magnetic impurity when the right at the impurity, if it flipped its direction at this distance and you put a magnetic impurity at that distance, it might be energetically favorable to have that magnetic impurity also be oppositely aligned to this one over here. And so you would expect, as drawn in this cartoon anyway, to have an antiferromagnetic interaction between the impurities. What happens in a condo lattice, if we think about a system where we're above the condo temperature, where we don't have the screening cloud, we have a magnetic moment or a magnetization at each one of our magnetic impurities. But if we just happen to leave behind a hole in the lattice, we can ask what happens. Well, there's no magnetic moment because there's no magnetic impurity there. If we take the same system and we drop below T condo, now we have a condo lattice where we have screening cloud made out of block waves, we might anticipate or suspect that although each one of these moments is compensated, that screening cloud continues across where the hole is left in the lattice, leaving us with a net magnetic moment, or if you like, a phantom moment. It shouldn't be a phantom moment, it should be a real moment. Harry liked the word phantom, but at the position where there is no magnetic impurity. So our scheme for trying to observe whether we have a condo lattice was to build arrays of these magnetic impurities, cobalt in this case, and leave behind a vacancy in the lattice. In this case, this shows you the full lattice. Here's the lattice with a vacancy. And our control experiment was done with a carbon monoxide molecule, non-magnetic. So we wanted to compare the results between the carbon monoxide and the cobalt case. Notice carbon monoxide images as a dip. We understand that a little bit. It's not important for today's lecture. Here are the results for cobalt. We originally got very enthused about these results. Here you see the STM topograph. There's the missing atom here in the center of the lattice. You can see the standing wave distribution due to surface day electrons in the center. The topograph gives us a strong dip here in the center. That's consistent with the dips at each one of these sites here. And if we make this DIDV difference map, what we find is a strong condo resonance signature at each one of the cobalt atoms, but right here in the center, which is as difficult to see as rendered here, but is much easier to see in this cross section along one of these lines here, that there appears to be a condo resonance signature right here at the center of that structure. Yeah?
What's the difference between what and
what? This is now the difference between the spectrum taken with the atom here at the center and the atom removed from the center. I said DIDV difference map. That was a mistake on my part. No, this is just a DIDV map. I'm sorry, I made a mistake. That was an error on my part. This is just a cross-section through the DIDV map, showing the strong condo resonance at each one of these positions, and then an apparent condo resonance, another strong spectroscopic feature at the center point. My error. Compare that with the control experiment, and you'll see that with the carbon monoxide molecules, where we do the same thing, it's completely featureless. So that we get some idea that this feature that we saw here, right, is not just due to the standing waves on the surface. It's condo resonant feature. And we demonstrated that also by just changing the voltage at which we do this experiment, so we weren't sensitive particularly to the condo resonance. And we could see this goes way down as you would expect. So at that point, we thought we had preliminary evidence for a condo lattice. And we were trying to think about what would be the good experiments to do. The experiment that we got most interested in was an experiment where we just changed the lattice constant. We breathed the lattice. And the reason we were interested in doing that is if you buy into this picture, then you would see that if we had the lattice as arranged with the lattice constant shown here, we would have an antiferromagnetic ordering between the condo impurities. If we doubled the lattice constant so that this was the nearest neighbor instead of the next nearest neighbor, we would have a ferromagnetic lattice. And we would still expect condo lattices in either case, but we have the opportunity on the surface to build whatever lattice we want, and we can build square lattices and we can build triangular lattices. The square lattices, we, in a naive way, would believe should support both anti-ferromagnetic and ferromagnetic ordering, but the triangular lattice should only support the ferromagnetic ordering, or if it supports something that is anti-ferromagnetic, it should be frustrated and it would be a very interesting system. So we were looking for a difference between our square lattice results and our triangular lattice results, which would be clearly indicative of magnetic ordering in these two systems. Yeah.
Is the magnetization of the cobalt atoms fixed, or does it go in resonance with the electron gas Fondo wave?
You would believe that it was oscillating all over the place, that in the sense that if there was no other, if there was nothing else to break the symmetry, if it was a magnetic impurity in the bulk, and let's put it in gellium, right, that the exchange interaction between the Fermi level electrons and the local moment on the impurity could give you a spin flip in basically into any direction, that there would be components that would couple, so that spin would be oscillating with the spins of the conduction electron cloud. It is my guess that in a system like a Kondo lattice that you should get some ordering and some net preferred direction, some anisotropy, which wants to have the moments aligned or anti-aligned along some direction. The surface itself is known to break the symmetry. Atoms on a surface like this quite often are found to have their moments directed perpendicular to the surface. So I would tend to want to orient the spins perpendicular to the surface, and I would expect those to still be fluctuating. But now there's this question of, when you have a lattice, how can they fluctuate if they're coupled strongly in the lattice? Do you still get fluctuations, or does the lattice lock up those fluctuations to some extent, and can you maintain a Kondo system under those set of circumstances? I think that is not well understood at this point. I can guarantee you I don't understand it. And it's food for thought.
What is the difference
between the difference is whether you're above or below a Kondo temperature. Whether in RKKY we think of a classical spin that's fixed, and an exchange scattering off of that spin polarizing the conduction electron gas. And then below the Kondo temperature, you would imagine that you have this fluctuating system that I just tried perhaps poorly to describe. But you would expect, if you believe that there could be a Kondo lattice like this, you certainly might expect that you could get some kind of magnetic ordering in an RKKY system also.
Let me suggest nobody should stay out of sheer politeness.
Right.
Okay, so if anybody's willing to go out or needs to go out, please feel free to do it, and maybe to do it now, because then all the noise will be localized in time.
Right.
And the real aficionados are willing to stay. Maybe we'll try to wind
it. Hopefully, yeah, 5 minutes. I think I can get there in 5 or 10 minutes or so. Although I don't want to turn off the questions. They make the talk much more interesting
sure.
for me, and I think for everybody. Yeah.
Okay, so this is basically another version of the last two questions, I think. Asking for the answer in a different language. So, at least from a theoretical point of view, if we talk about a Kondo lattice, then one of the ideas would be competition between Kondo screening at the moment and the RKKY. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So, you could expect two different regimes, one where the Kondo effect dominates, and then at low temperatures you have screen moments, and the other regime would be where the
RKKY. You might even imagine multiple regimes. There may be. You might even think that there would be a lattice temperature, which might be lower than the Kondo temperature. So that first, as you cool down, you first drop into a Kondo regime, and then later on into a phase where the magnetic moments are. The fluctuations in those magnetic moments are coupled, or you have a Kondo lattice, perhaps. That's rank speculation, with emphasis on the word rank.
Well, maybe, but you might think that if the Kondo temperature is a higher scale, then the moments get screened, and that knew she was nothing to order. So really my question was, you seem to be implying that probably in your system the RKKY dominates.
If you believe that we had evidence for a condo lattice, I'm about to tell you that I don't think we do. But that's completely aside from the physics that you were just discussing. My understanding at this point of the way to think about a condo lattice is perhaps that the fluctuations that you think of due to the scattering, exchange scattering of the conduction electrons with the local moment might lead to a correlated fluctuation, but you'd still be in the condo regime. So that when one system flips, when the moment on one atom flips, the whole rest of the lattice has to do it, which might make that flipping very slow. And so that might actually force you above, might effectively lower the condo temperature, if you like, by bringing these atoms together, forcing you back into an RKKY-like regime. Perhaps that's one way to think about it. It effectively makes the spins more classical because of the effect of neighboring spins. Makes them more rigid. Yeah?
Can I use the number for the quantum resonance field that you quoted for 9 millivolts basically quantum
temperature? Yeah, it's around 50 Kelvin. That's the estimate that we make, and we believe that that's reasonable. We don't have independent experimental verification of this, and the reason is mundane. It's an experimental problem that these atoms, long before we get up to the condo temperature of 50 Kelvin or so, these atoms become mobile, and we can't do experiments on them while they're moving around.
And the assumption is that the main
problem is with 2D electrons. I'm sorry, the assumption is, say
again.
I would not use the word main. I would say that we have evidence that the surface state electrons, the 2D electrons, are participating in the condo resonance, but I don't have any evidence to say that they're dominating over the bulk electrons. Maybe there is evidence, and you can see how that could be derived from the data, but I don't see how to do that. There was one other. The effect of the magnetic field, everybody wants to do that. There's at least 4 groups around the world that are racing to turn on their magnetic fields and see what happens. So anyway, we tried to do this lattice breathing experiment with the hope that we could see a difference between the square and the triangular lattices. I can show you pictures which demonstrate that we know how to make square lattices, even on a triangular surface, something that comes close to being square. But let me just skip to the results so we can all have lunch. This is just a snapshot of the results. This is the spectrum taken over a hole in a square lattice. This is a larger square lattice, another hole in the square lattice. And the red dots here are the results of Greg Feith's and Rick Heller's scattering theory. And so they're already properly predicting what we get in the holes of these lattices. In addition, although I don't have it here, I'm really surprised that we didn't ever make a view graph out of it, although this is data that's only less than a month old. What we found is that as we made the lattice larger, as we gently breathed the lattice to the extent that we could, instead of just having a dip here, sometimes we would have a downward step, sometimes we would have an upward step, and sometimes we would have a bump. And what we found is that the scattering theory properly got that. It got all of that right. What that was a result of is just what I tried to diagram out here. What we're doing when we change the lattice constant is we're changing the distance between the tip of the microscope when it's over the vacancy and the nearest cobalt atoms on the surface, which are dominating what we're seeing. And it can all be interpreted within the framework of just changing the phase between the outgoing wave and the scattered wave. And as you change that phase, you change the shape of the condo resonance signature that you see. So we now know that experimentally, everything that I've talked to you about in the condo lattice can be accounted for by the single particle scattering theory, in which case there's no need to invoke any kind of condo lattice explanation of what we've got going on. Our data does not rule out the presence of a lattice, but I'd say it's certainly not in any way compelling. And so we're at the point where we're asking ourselves, what would we do if we really wanted to create one of these condo lattices that people think exist? How would we get a strong enough coupling? What systems would we be trying to create? What magnetic impurities, what surfaces would we want in order to optimize this kind of effect? There, any guidance that I could achieve, you could provide me would be very greatly appreciated. And let me thank you both for your politeness, your questions, and for your tolerance letting me blab this long. Thank you.
Talk. I think what we should do is again allow people to get out, and some of us can stay and ask questions. Don is going to be here, I think it's room 2004 for the afternoon, and people are welcome to come and chat with
1204. 1204. 1204.
Oh, yeah, you're right. Experimental is so better at details. So nobody wants to get out. So.
Given all the agreement with theory, it seems a little bit mean-spirited to look at the disagreement. But in this, in the transparency that you drew the diagram here, where you put the tip on the vacant site, there was an upper graph which showed the tip moved around. No, much earlier, just before you start talking about the condo lattices.
You're thinking of this one.
Yeah.
Or even, I know which one. I know which one you want. I know exactly which. Yeah, there's a large discrepancy between theory and data.
Yeah.
Right. What's going on here is your question.
Yeah.
Maybe we should get to work on that. I think the only honest answer to that is we recognize that as a discrepancy, but we haven't resolved it. Whether I think sometimes that it might have been due to the particular electronic structure of the tip. I think that electronic structure was the same when we did these measurements as it was when we did this measurement over here. So it's a point well taken. Maybe that's a clue into maybe there's something special about that position. I don't know what it would be. So good point.
You make it sound as if it was a very lucky accident that you saw this mirage. With the argument that it had to do with this particular idea for the two just being at the family energy. But now I think in this scattering picture, perhaps it is not such a lucky accident, because you probably couple to all states, and it just happens that this particular state was particularly useful because the other cobalt atom is sitting right there. And then perhaps it should be much more stable, and I think after all you find it so often, so
yeah, I think we would agree with one another. Let me rephrase it. What we're seeing, this local modulator creating this perturbation of an eigenmode, that should happen for any eigenmode, and it should happen basically wherever you put the modulator. Even if you just happen to put it at a nodal point, well, there's no effect. So it doesn't have to be elliptical. It could be any shape quantum state that you like. It could be in three dimensions, one dimensions, two dimensions. The physics all stays the same. But the effect has to be large enough for us to be able to see. And it turns out, otherwise we don't have enough signal to noise to see the effect. Some of these measurements are scraping for signal noise. But although we always get better at it. And so if you were to ask yourself, what would be the condition under which you could see this effect, where the effect would be made largest, it's that condition where the state is highly peaked at just two positions, and had we made a slight, and we're looking at this condo resonance, so it had to be, because that's what we were interested in, and so it was fortuitous that we just happened to pick a structure which gives us a state which is highly peaked at just two positions, and it was the size to put that state right at the Fermi energy. I will not dismiss the role of luck in these results. You're very lucky.
There's a simple question. Just when you bring all your cobalt F together, how do you determine whether the magnetic moment aligns?
We,
do you apply a small field, or do they just want to align parallel?
We don't know. We don't have a tool that allows us to do that. And there are probably 15 groups in the world that are working very hard to try to develop the capability of answering that very good, very simple question that you just asked. In what direction are the moments pointing? We would love to be able to make such measurements.
Are they pointing in the same direction or no way?
I don't know.
It's not possible to, I don't know, take a magnetic tip or something and try to flip the edge.
If you just took a magnetic tip in a system like this, there's a very good likelihood that the field from that tip would completely dominate the physics of the system. It would align those moments, and then you wouldn't have contrast in that sense.
No, I mean, like, I don't know, just to align it at first.
Well, but then then if it fluctuates, and you'd have to know that there was a change afterwards. I don't see how to do that in the easy way that you're thinking of, and that's because these moments are rather delicate things. There's no reason why it should want to point in one direction or another other than the local physics due to the interaction of the magnetic atoms with one another and through the anisotropy that's created by their interaction with the surface. Right. Right. Most interestingly, there is a calculation by Sasha Belatsky, which indicates that even the non-magnetic local density of states, the total local density of states around the magnetic impurity, when you include both exchange interaction and spin orbit interaction, gives you a non-spherical density distribution, which we hope to be able to measure. And that's an encouraging, and it's an encouraging calculation. It leads us to believe that there is yet another possible way in which we might be able to interrogate these very small magnetic systems in a non-perturbative way. And that's very important for us. We have to be careful with these systems. Perhaps like that. We can design systems like this on a computer and get them to work in the laboratory. The purpose here was to design a system where we could have a state which was highly peaked in three positions, so that we could create a large effect at one point, let's say at this point, which is shown here, due to an atom either here or two atoms, and create an effect there. I'm giving you something which is what we call a logical or mirage thing. We can't call it a gate, yet it's not a gate. So in the absence of any other language, we call it a mirage thing. We're very profound in IBM in the way we label things. With just a PC, it's amazing, and some simple math programs, you can quantum engineer these systems in quite simple way, and actually see quite good agreement between the states that you've engineered on the computer and what you actually observe in the laboratory. It's very satisfying that way.
Can I try three? And like,
if you have three,
and
I like this.
Symmetric and like magnetic frustration or something? And what's going on in the lab?
No, we haven't, and it's very interesting to do so. I'm sorry. Is it, when we create a lattice of the cobalt, is it enough to
impose a gap structure on the dispersion of the electron?
We always see that. Whenever we put an atom on the surface, Even just one atom on the surface, it will change the spectroscopy that we measure out at some distance, because there will be the scattered wave which comes back, giving us energy-dependent wiggles every time we add in another 2 pi worth of phase shift.
Right.
Almost certainly you would, and I don't recall that we looked for it. The only thing that would really prevent you from seeing that, though, and we might not, I should be a little bit more careful, is the scattering of the atoms is very lossy. There's a large scattering cross section into one of these three loss channels. Right? And to the extent that becomes too large, then you tend to kill the surface states entirely. Nonetheless, inside of our corrals, we do see resonant results, as I showed you. And so you would expect to see that modified band structure, just as I think. Just, it would be broadened substantially.
Last question.
Okay.
So actually, your mirage phenomenon is can be traced back to classical speculars reflecting, right?
Mm-hmm.
In this field. On the other hand, we know that if we make a superconducting environment, then we have strictly backscattering called Andreev scattering.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, so in case of specular reflection, you just produce the mirage. In the case of Andreev reflection, you will act only on the atom itself. And the question is, I just asked myself, what will happen then? Because it could be a resonant action on the effect itself. And,
We have asked ourselves that question, or an equivalent question, or similar questions many times, and we're poor men. We don't know of a superconducting system which has we have a two-dimensional electron gas, which itself, with a 2D gas, is superconducting, in which we can do these experiments. The physics should be just as interesting in 3D, but it's not the kind of experiment that we can readily set up and probe. Nonetheless, the notion of Andreev reflections at scatterers in or on a superconductor is something that should provide some pretty interesting physics. We have never put on a superconductor a Kondo system and known that we've been below the Kondo temperature. Indeed, how could you have a Kondo atom if you don't have any state density? So what happens? Can you get something like a Kondo system when you have these mid-gap states in the vicinity of magnetic impurity? But those are, you have to have a strong enough magnetic impurity, otherwise those states are just excitations. The physics probably gets pretty, to me, the physics sounds interesting. I was going to say complicated, but that's also fun for us. And so I just don't know how to do it in a simple and clear kind of experiment.
Okay. Every good thing must finish sometime. Thank you very much.
Thank you.